Welcome to Developing Leadership, the podcast where I, Isaac Kent, and my co-host Jason Warner talk about our lessons learned on engineering leadership throughout the years. Today we have writer, community creator, and engineering leader at Apple, Michael Lopp, on the podcast, but you might know him better as Rance from Twitter, the author of Small Things Done Well. He joined us to talk about the power of storytelling in engineering leadership and the state of content for engineering leaders. We also spoke about online meetings and our opinions on creating more authentic communications with remote teams. We didn't get super technical on this one, but as always, if you hear a topic on today's episode that you would like to learn more about, make sure to check out this episode's show notes linked in the description.
Developing leadership.
Hi, everyone. We're back again for another episode of Developing Leadership. Jason and I have a guest with us today, Michael. Michael, you're not just an engineering leader with quite the resume. You're also the creator of Rants and Repos and one of the largest communities of engineering leaders on Slack. And so we're excited to have you with us today and would love to ask you to give the introduction about yourself.
Hi, good morning. It's very early here on the East Coast of West Coast of California. So coffee's kicking in. Anyway, I'm Michael Lopp on the internet. You probably think of me as Rans. Rans is my wife's maiden name. Everyone always asks that. That's why I have that name. I've been running around the Silicon Valley for the last couple of decades, working at companies like Slack and Pinterest and Palantir and Apple and Borland and Netscape. So I've been doing a lot of things. And I quickly realized as I became a manager that no one had written anything interesting down to me as an engineer. There's lots of books out there, but they're all like vapid Tony Robbins garbage. Sorry, Tony. And it was good stuff, but it just didn't speak to me as an engineer. So I started about, I don't know, many years ago, I started writing a blog, which turned into books and then turned into this large leadership community that is one of the things that has been the least work, but the most powerful thing that I think I've had been contributed to in terms of people learning from each other. Happy to be here.
Fantastic. Great to have you on. And actually, if you look at, you mentioned something interesting, right? The state of content for engineering leaders, it still hasn't improved very much. You're still one of the few
authors.
You're one of the few authors out there. And, but still, when you look at the desks of people, when you walk through an office, for those of you who still work in an office, you still find the same 3-4 books every single time.
Yeah.
Before we dive into today's topics, why do you think that is?
Engineers are kind of jerks. We have our sort of specific way of like that we like to work and like we speak and whatnot. And we're pretty particular, which is a privilege, by the way. And it's it kind of means that we kind of find our own language, literally, that we work in and that we speak in. And I think if there's an appeal to some of my stuff, it's because as an engineer, I'm speaking to you as an engineer and you're hearing it as an engineer. So I think it's a tone thing. I think it's a not necessarily a values thing, but just like you're at a bar and you're talking with your favorite engineer and she's railing on this and you're railing on that. You're speaking in a certain way. And I think that's kind of the thing is that we get used to our little cliques and sort of communities. And that's the thing is these other leadership books, which are great material by folks, are speaking too broadly, or they're speaking too, you know, poetry like or whatever. Like this great writing, but it's not necessarily appealing to sort of the engineering community.
I couldn't agree more with you there. So let's be opinionated. Let's be engineers and let's have some discussion. And ahead of this episode, you know, Michael essentially sent an email about the topics. And one of the things was why video conferencing blows. And I know probably the three of us are going to have different opinions on this today. And we're seeing each other on video, FYI.
Yeah.
So Michael, share with us a little bit your point of view on this.
All right. So I've got to do two disclaimers. Number one is we have to do this right now because there's a pandemic. So that's number one. I'm going to come out negative on video conferencing, by the way. But we're doing this because it's the healthy, it's the right thing, it's the sensible thing to do right now. That's number one. Number two is like it works. It's like guaranteed. It's been working for years and years and years. So, but here's number three. Did you see Rogue One? Yes, this is relevant. You saw Rogue One? Nod if you can. You saw it. Okay, right? Remember at the end there's a scene in the, you see Princess Leia, right? And you come in and it's this big reveal at the end. Sorry, spoiler alert if you didn't see Rogue One, but Princess Leia's in it. She's not in it. It's a CG Princess Leia. And you know it immediately. And if I showed you a picture of it right now, it's literally on my screen right now, you'd be like, huh, yes, that's Princess Leia. No, that's not Princess Leia, because something's wrong. And this is my fundamental core issue with video conferencing. Is Princess Leia? What? How am I going to pull this off? It's because we as humans have these seven senses that we have developed over the last bajillion years by learning about who you are, this person across from me at the table, in the cave, in the conference room. And I know exactly by looking at you, who you are, what you're thinking, where's your mood. And the thing about the Princess Leia thing is, like, go look at it sometime and you'll be like, oh yeah, he's right. It doesn't look quite right. Tell me why it doesn't look right. You can't tell me. A CG expert, a person who understands how humans look, would say, like, well, the eyes are dead and this thing and blah, blah, blah. But you don't know. But you actually do know, because you can see it when you go, like, something is wrong here. And this is the thing we've been in for the last 20 months. I'm looking at the two of you right now, and I'm kind of getting a read on you. I don't know how tall you are. I don't know if you're wearing pants. I don't know all of these very interesting things that if we were sitting here in the cafeteria or wherever we would be, we're living in this world where all of this other context that we became used to working together is now gone. Now, is it a disaster? No, the disaster is there's this pandemic going on, and that's horrible. But in terms of working together, in terms of us gathering context and sharing things and the serendipity and the water cooler talk, it's all gone. And we've found powerful ways, including Slack and lots of thumbs up and nodding and all this stuff that we're doing in video conferencing. I fundamentally think there's this thing that is missing. It can work. It can work fine. But I'm deeply looking forward to a world where we're sitting here and, like, I'm drinking coffee and I can see that your body position is a little bit off. And I know by looking at that you're somehow uncomfortable with something that's going on. I can't do that right now. I literally met someone that I hired like 6 months ago for the first time. And I'm like, oh, you're super tall. I had no idea. Does that matter to, like, how we're building our software? No, but it's still, there's this little bits of context that are missing right now. So thanks for listening to my TED talk. That's why I don't like video conferencing.
Well, Michael, I think everything you said was right. I think that's what we're over here kind of thinking about, is that we actually probably have, like, slightly different opinions, but everything you said is right. And this is, like you said, thousands of years or millennia of all these different intrinsic things that we know about each other. But also, on the flip side, the world we live in, not even just from the pandemic, but, you know, because of business, requires us sometimes to do these things remote. So I've always found myself in a position where I keep thinking about, okay, maybe not what we should do, but what do we have to do sometimes too? And I also say this as an executive who's been remote for 12 years. I've, you know, GitHub and Heroku and Canonical, I've always done those remote with some in-person time and heavier in-person time at times too. But part of what I've done remote is, if you're watching on video, you're going to see this. My hands are going everywhere. My head is moving. My eyes are wide. I'm trying to fake a smile sometimes and pretend ISO is funny. I'm trying to show everything. And even if you're only hearing this, I'm doing something intentional. I'm trying to be more inflective or maybe slow down at certain times, emphasize. Like, there's certain things you have to do in the audio or video world that you don't have to do while you're in person. So 100% agree with you. Also, you know, other things that we've got to figure out as well to do in a video world.
There's another piece here. I've been, like, looking for, like, the thing that we truly, truly lost here. And the little subtle things of gathering context and whatnot. The thing that I think is I'm actually really worrying about is more the serendipity in the water cooler moments of I can smell this team. Something's wrong with this team. I don't know why. I can't tell you exactly. But, oh, look, there's Ashley. Ashley is just standing right there. Hey, Ashley, who just happened to be there for reasons I don't understand. What's this thing I smell? Do you smell this? He's like, oh, yeah, it's a total disaster. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? The fact that I bumped into him, the fact that he and I both had, like, this spider-sensey thing, and we both left that and went, okay, we're going to go put that at the top of the list and go fix it right now, right? That sort of early warning system, sort of serendipity bumping into people thing, that's gone. It doesn't happen in Slack. I mean, you're not going to know that something's awry by looking at the emoji, right? So that's the other piece that I worry about and again, I'm so biased about working together because I really, really, really like that sort of signal and whatnot. But that's the thing. I'm like, why is this thing blowing up? I'm like, oh, we didn't talk to each other we've been throwing it into a meeting, or we're throwing it into a Slack channel or whatnot, but we're not actually getting that sort of spidey sense, sort of awareness of how things are like moving along. That's still super subjective and touchy-feely, but like, that's another thing that I think is hard for us to discern.
So this is, I think this is actually the root of a lot of people's challenges with the remote cultures that are kind of emerging, is you can't, there's something about in person where you, the spidey sense goes off. Yeah. And I can tell you, and this is, I've been, again, remote now for 12 years. I have pretty strong opinions on like the modes, maybe the tools we should use. Yeah. And the one thing I will say that I absolutely hate about being remote is when someone says you should be full async. And that to me is actually one of the biggest challenges, because just a GitHub issue or a Slack channel or whatever, I don't find that you can get any of those signals. And in fact, I think there's, I've come to this opinion that you have to be explicit way more in remote and video than you can be implicit in person. So what you said, the water cooler, I kind of think is implicit. You just happen to run into Ashley and all that sort of stuff. Yep. And what I find is that if you're in a meeting, there's that awkward pause. And the awkward pause to me is somewhere inside there. You say, okay, hang on a sec. What's going on? Who's not saying the thing that they want to say? That sort of thing. And then you have to take note of that, because afterwards you have to go almost talk to everyone individually, because someone's not going to want to say it in the room in front of other people. So on the manager or the executive, it's actually a lot more work. That is actually probably one of the challenges.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's that reading the room and going like, why isn't she talking? I know she cares about this architecture a lot. So yep. she can't figure out how to interject into all of this people who are just trying to jump all over each other in terms of conversation. There's a lot more work there in terms of managing the conversation, like looking at it and reading the grid and going, okay, Ashley's super unhappy. I can tell from this little postage stamp on my screen.
It is harder work, and I find it to be, it's also suboptimal. It's less effective. And this is the thing, whenever I get called in a lot, especially during the early part of the pandemic for large organizations that had to, when they were forced to go remote. And the one thing I've told all the executives was, everyone here, it's on you. And then one level below them, it's on them for the level below them, and et cetera. And they said, well, that's not the way it should work. I just laughed. I'm like, using the word should is not something we likely could have in our vocabulary at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's just what you need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So that's interesting, because like you, Jason, I've been remote now, I think going on 5 years. And in the last 2 years, I've been building a new company where we still haven't met in person. So it's 2 years in. Finally, the pandemic is getting to a point where people living across different countries, we can travel and meet each other soon. And so was forced to actually do all the extra work. And this is kind of the funny thing is, I agree with both of your opinions, but at the same time, there's something that underlies all this, which is when you are remote, all the problems, and everyone knows me for saying 99% of all problems in organization are communication problems. And to me, the physical office, the space where you share together, you've built up ways to figure out those communication problems for exactly what you're talking about. But those problems still exist. You found a way to work around them. The moment you have a remote culture, and I do asterisk this, with it's a lot easier to build that from scratch from trying to implement that in an organization in the middle of a pandemic, you know, tens of thousands of people. But when you look at some of the future of companies that are building fully remote, from day one, that is explicit. It's like, yes, we have to do extra work. Yes, as a leader, you're going to have to spend more time getting to know people. You're going to have to do more, you know, Zoom calls. But then there's the flip side of it, is how much you can actually do, right? How much you can actually fit in your day. All of a sudden, at least to me, the fact of being remote gives you this opportunity of being far more explicit and effective and building that culture in an organization where people say, hey, we are going to take effort to communicate. We are going to write things down, and we're going to have the meeting about it. To me, there's one thing that's never discussed, and I haven't heard it discussed publicly, and I'm not sure if anybody's going to strongly disagree with me about this, because it might be a bit controversial. As a leader, so much about what makes you a great leader is your inner game, right? And you and I, Jason, have talked about this a lot. It's about how you bring yourself to that meeting, to that day, no matter if you're tired, exhausted, if the company is going through a crisis or it's going through, you know, it's boom period. And when you're sitting in a room together, the positive feelings and the excitement of what's happening definitely rubs off on everyone else. But the opposite side of it as well, And some of that stuff might have nothing to do with work. I think particularly throughout the pandemic, this is very clear, right? If someone's having an incredibly tough time at home, before in the office, that would radiate to the rest of the team. What I found very interesting around video conferencing remote is that you come into a meeting with intention. So no matter what is going on in your life, no matter what else is happening, you can set that intention and come into those 30 or 60 minutes and be very explicit. And while you don't have some of the positive effects of things that might radiate, and you have to do those things that you mentioned, Jason, you have to put a smile and think about the intonation on your voice, you can also use that for the negative side effects that you might have from being in person.
I agree 100%. Yeah, agreed. I think, like, again, I'm going back to what Michael said earlier, which is, yeah, it's true. If we can all be together in person, it just, things are just easier and it's going to be more magical, more serendipitous. It's going to feel more natural. Like, I don't know. We spent a couple of days together in Lisbon just a week ago or so. Much easier than just doing this. And we've known each other for years too. And Sam, who we had on a couple of podcasts ago, he and I are friends. Every time we go to San Francisco, it's easier to condense a couple of hours of conversations into minutes. It's just the way it works. On the flip side, we got to find a way to make this work. It's kind of the nature of the game.
I also think there's a massive amount of opportunity, right? Because Jason, you and I met first, I don't know how many years ago, in person over a dinner, a one-on-one dinner, and then hadn't seen each other until last week in person for years. And throughout that built, you know, like a great friendship, relationship over those years, entirely through video, often at times sitting on opposite sides of an ocean. And so I do think it's possible, but you're right. It takes a lot more work. And the days we got to spend together definitely are needed to have those checkpoints to kind of level up a relationship is maybe not the right word to use. But I think this comes to your point of finding that balance between spending time together at a human level. And I'm even a fan about doing that and not talking about work and having actually explicit meetings that could be on Zoom and that are about work.
I mean, I'm not going to disagree. I think it's just easier and more fun to do it that way and not talk about work and get to know each other on the human level. I also think that, again, going back to what you can do in situations, it's just, we wouldn't be friends if we didn't take the opportunity to do it over Zoom. If we always waited to get in person, you and I would be acquaintances, not friends. And so missed opportunities for sure. And, you know, this is actually something I'm struggling with in my new job, because part of VC is a relationship game. And a lot of the relationship is touch and feel. And you've got to get in front of folks. But in a world like this, how do you do that?
Yeah.
But just in general, I think, like, you know, on the topic, video kind of sucks. But got to figure out a way to do that. And so let me put it in the positive spin, because I'm always looking for the one, I'm a glass half full, but also opportunistic, is put it this way. If you get good at this, it's a superpower. And let me flip it around one other way. So, like, as a person, if you get good at being able to connect with people, video or audio or all that, it's a superpower. Here's another one. If your company can operate in a distributed fashion and your leaders, and I want to be very, very explicit about this, your leaders know how to communicate, know how to be effective, know how to organize, know how to execute in a remote fashion. If you're good at that, you're an excellent in-person company in all likelihood. So, but it's not the same. If you're a good in-person company and you had to translate to remote, you're likely a bad, because there's a whole bunch of things that are implicit, as I was mentioning before, about being in-person, but you have to make explicit as you go remote or distributed. So if you make those things explicit, they're actually, again, become superpowers for you in person. This is just one of those things that I've come to understand. And I think this is also why, as an engineering and product leader over the last decade or so, the organizations that I've been a part of, you've always seen a massive uptick in effectiveness. If you come in, you start saying, well, we're going to write that down. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And all of a sudden you start making some of the hidden work visible, as an example, or some of the implicit things that people are known more explicit. It just kind of happens that way. But on my part too, it's more about explicit communication and getting the organization to be explicit in their communication.
So, Michael, I know you are a big fan of written communication and writing things down and the importance of writing. And that, I think, extends to one of those superpowers. Share with us a little bit your point of view on this.
I mean, it's sort of related. What you were just saying is sort of, if you didn't write it down, it never happened. That's what it says on the field notes books. If you didn't write it down, it never happened. But I think it's actually more powerful than sort of just having a written record of that decision or that discussion or whatever the heck happened that you want to capture and share with other people. I had an interview once, and the exec asked me, he's like, hey, because I'd written a book, and they're like, hey, did writing a book make you a better leader? And I'm like, huh, what a great question, which is what you say when you're stalling to figure out a good answer. But her question was really good, because I'm like, oh yeah, the reason I think it makes me a better leader is, ask me about one-on-ones. I will bore you to death with my thoughts on one-on-ones. But everything that I'm telling you is actually something that I've written down. I've passed it through my fingers and I've considered it. It's not just me like YOLO sounding like I can just extemporaneously tell you great things about one-on-ones. I'm just reading you the blog posts or the blog posts about it. And when I choose to go and write something down, the idea goes from like me kind of just thinking in the back of my head to something far more thoughtful and well-constructed. A little Carrie Fisher pitch I gave you at the beginning of this thing, that's a presentation that I'm giving in Poland in about 2 weeks, sitting on my screen right now, because I'm sitting here thinking about the pandemic and distributed work. And I was watching Rogue One. I'm like, why does Carrie Fisher look so weird? And I'm like, oh, this is the whole problem. All of this signal is missing. And I'm like, oh, that's great. So now I have this interesting story about Carrie Fisher and why I don't like distributed work or video conference. I like distributed work. Video conferencing is hard. So that's writing. That's the art of taking that thought and making it a coherent narrative. And that's actually what leadership is too. So last night someone sent me this horrible, horrible status update that they were sending out. And they're like, I copied it, put it into Bear, my favorite editor in the world, and just rewrote it right there. It was one paragraph. It was awful. I turned it into two paragraphs and it was very readable. This is a little tiny thing that goes in a status report that no one's ever going to read. But it just gave me a little joy to like take this poor piece of writing and to make it good again. Right. So that's a skill that I've learned over decades, is that what is clear writing versus just, you know, things that kind of showed up in my head. And it's a practice and a skill that you build. And it's, I think for leaders, it's an essential skill to have, is that ability to convey thoughts through writing.
I could not agree with you more. And in fact, one of the things I've always appreciated about you, Michael, and obviously your writing has been influential to a lot of people, including myself, over the years, is your ability to tell stories about that, or to give examples, or to make things relatable, all of those things. And I think that's incredibly important, particularly as you go up in the leadership ranks, because there's a whole bunch of set of skills which are like the basics. But it's one of those things that's the basics. It just covers a wide category of things. We could talk all day about expectation setting and goal setting and all of those, but like this right here, what you do with the stories is so important, because people, ISO has heard me say this, there's that Maya Angelou quote, which is, people will forget what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. Well, stories are actually how they'll actually remember what you said as well as how you made them feel too. So I think that's really important. I was going to say, one thing that's actually helped me as a engineering leader, product leader, is writing. But learning how to write books, and I know you've written a bunch of books, but there's this method, and I think I would encourage people to think about this or go find it. It's called the snowflake method for science fiction writing or something like that. And the whole idea is that you start small and you build. So you don't start with the entire novel in your head, but you start with a small premise and you start to slowly, methodically, over the course of a couple of weeks, build it. And that's actually how I've done product development in the past too, which is like, I would like to do X. You think of it as a triangle, and then you add the next triangle slightly askew, then the next triangle. And then by the time you're done, you have a fractal of a snowflake from adding triangles all the way through. And I have found that, just from a mental model perspective, to be incredibly useful.
Yeah. My model is different. I don't write science fiction novels. My model is, in terms of the starting with something and turning it into something which is a significant piece of writing, is kind of like what you just said, is I find the story. And once I know what the story is, like I know I can tell you about this thing because I had this epiphany about Carrie Fisher or whatever the thing is. That's the piece that actually gets me, because I'm like in my head, like I've got like 8 articles in my head or like on the screen right now. And some of them are like sitting there kind of just, and I'm looking for that spark of like, how do I'm going to open the door and start telling this story? And it just bounces around, and sometimes it just stops bouncing and it just goes in the slush pile. But there's this moment sometimes where you're like, oh, Carrie Fisher. That's right. That's it. There it is. I can frame the whole thing here. Like 80% of it won't be about Carrie Fisher, but it's suddenly this story that lands and gives it feeling and heart. And that's where it comes. But again, these are smaller sort of like pieces on like a topic, as opposed to like a space opera.
So, Michael, I'd love to dive deeper into storytelling within a leadership function, not just for creating great content. If you look back over your career, are there examples, and particularly I'm thinking around alignment. I heard a quote this week, and I think it's attributed, it was in secondhand through the CISO of Workday, who says, velocity is not about speed, velocity is about alignment. And when I think about storytelling as a leader, I think about alignment. And so I'm curious to see how you've used your skills to build alignment or consensus with storytelling.
Yeah, there's a really cool part of this and a really super boring part of what I'm about to say. The cool part is kind of what we just said in that, like, let's say I'm doing a reorg or something where I'm taking a team from point A to point B. So the fun part is to figure out the story about why we're doing this. There's some story there. And just like we just said, it can't be just like, we're improving alignment and increasing efficiency, because who the hell cares about that? We all care about it, but it's a boring story. I mean, it's a good thing, but it's like, it's a boring story. Like, but I'm making this up. This team we're under-resourced here, and I want us to be able to do these three big, huge things over the next 3 years. And these things are X, Y, and Z. And boy, all three of them seem impossible, right? Let's go for it. So I just made that up. And you're smiling because I can tell, because I'm on video conference, I can see it. So that's far more interesting than alignment and efficiencies and blah, 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 blah. So that's part one of the lesson that I've learned, is like, find that story to describe this big strategic thing that we're actually going to go into. And that's super hard. The boring part of this is, we engineers hate what I'm about to say, is then you go tell that story about 3,000 times, not 1,000, but 3,000 times. And at about 120, you're like, this is so dumb. Why am I still telling this story about these three things we have to go to? That's the job, especially during a pandemic, of you just need to be out there just kind of retelling it and selling. And sometimes people say, like, what do you mean by that? And you're like, oh, edit. Great. Okay. Story's a little bit better right now. But there's this piece of just, and this is when we like, when I really actually do reorgs, and everyone's like, all these engineers just want, okay, I get it. Now let's move on to the next thing. I'm like, no. Everyone needs to hear it. And they need to hear it again. And then the people that are affected need to hear it twice, and they need to sleep on it and talk to you the day out. Like, there's this whole cascading thing. And it's just incredibly hard and boring. But if you don't do it, something's going to blow up. Someone's going to feel bad, blah, 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 blah. So that's the part of it, that is this operational side of the storytelling that you have to do. Oh, and by the way, every time I tell the story, you have to believe it's the first time I'm saying it, because I'm so inspired by it. It's not the 200,000th time that I've actually said the story. So that's the storytelling piece, but there's an operational side to it that is as important, because everyone needs to hear that story and they need to believe it, and it needs to be repeated, and the organism needs to get it in the bloodstream. So,
as an engineer, I've tried to give people a little bit of a context around this in terms of, like, hey, how does this actually work? I say, well, you have to say something seven times to be heard, and then you have to say that same thing, or you have to hear something seven times to have it understood. So you're talking about 49 times effectively that you've got to say the same thing to the same audience for it to fully grok in, if you're talking about an org. So I just give people that same sort of advice. But I also then say, too, modes matter too. You probably have to write it down, probably have to do a video, probably going to do an all hands, some Q&A, and you're going to have variance on this. And yeah, you are going to hate saying we're doing this because of this reason, but it's so critically important.
Yeah. There's another piece that you just reminded me of relative to reorgs, but I think it's really any sort of big sort of change that you're taking the team to. There's usually some sort of visual or written artifact, like for the reorg, that I go down and I do it 10x better than anybody else, because I know that this is the one thing that's going to travel the furthest. So, like, for a reorg, I have a slide guy who actually does the reorg slide, and he's genius at Keynote and whatnot, because that's the thing everyone's going to care about, is like, who works for her and what happened to Ashley and da da da, that sort of thing. That thing is the thing that I do 10x more work on than, you know, the other pieces, because that's the thing that's going to kind of encapsulate and wander around and be the thing that is one of those repetition moments for folks.
Great call out on that too, because the virality of something. And this is where also something you say in person can go. It's like, well, what did Jason just say? So that's why you have to actually follow it up with written too and say, oh, just go check out the blog post and the slide deck.
Yeah, I get a lot of mileage out of my blog post. Yeah, but don't tell them that. They got to think it's real. And that boy, they're like, this is the first, wow, I'm just making this up the first time right now. And you're the most important person in this conversation. And whoa.
I don't know if either of you have had this during the pandemic, but I've definitely had, you know, days where your spouse or comes and says, I can tell this story now. I've heard it so many times. I've heard you say it over Zoom. If you want, I can come on the next call.
Yeah, I have the same thing. My wife is very aware of my day-to-day, unfortunately.
Fantastic. So, Michael, writing is a superpower. I think we spoke a lot today about making things explicit, right? I think if we, funny enough, started off on video conferencing and thought we would all disagree, and turns out we all keep agreeing. But it all pretty much comes down to, you know, it's the world that we live in today, where remote is just likely going to stay a big part of it, means that we have to be even more explicit as leaders. Is there anything non-obvious that you've been more explicit about in these last couple of years?
This is sort of related to it. The other thing about the water cooler when I'm talking with Ashley is like, I can see how I can check in and be like, hey, how's life? And he says, nothing at all. I'm like, cool, I'll move on. And then the other time I say, hey, how's life? And he says something. I'm like, oh, I need to check in here. And this has nothing to do with work. I mean, it is work because we're coworkers, but like, there's that sort of like, you know, that banter that we have sort of just as we're walking around and bumping into each other and you're kind of checking in on things and sort of doing mental health checks on folks and whatnot. That's all gone because we're sitting here as trapped in these boxes. So I'm finding what explicitly at the beginning of, you know, staff meetings, to like, I literally am scanning and I'm checking for like differences in their background. I'm like, oh, you have a new book there. Da, da, da. And I'm doing that to create that cohesion piece, that social cohesion piece that is gone right now. And I also have a standing agenda item for the end of my staff meeting called Gossip, Rumors, and Lies. And all we do is we just kind of say, I'm like, hey, so what are you here? Right. And this is all off the record. No one's writing anything down, but it's just sort of like, hey, by the way, I heard we're never, ever going back into the campus ever again. That's a lie. But people, and it's like, it's the best part of my week, by the way. It's the last 20 minutes of an hour long staff meeting. And it always starts off kind of quiet. And then 3 minutes later, we're all just laughing and kind of going, did you hear that? And I'm like, I didn't hear that. That's so weird. Blah, blah, blah. The reason that it's such a rich time is because we're all trapped in these boxes right now and we don't actually get to go do that. So I'm doing that. And that, like, it's, we did it when I first started at my current gig, but it wasn't that interesting. It's super interesting now because people want that. We're these social creatures. We like that connection and sort of that random poetic inspiration of hearing what Myra has to say about this thing over here. So I'm spending a lot more. I spend time doing that piece there. And then one-on-ones too. It's still, you know, we did it before when we were all like hanging out together. We kind of say, hey, how's it going? No. But now you really actually have to do it to kind of, you know, just open it and kind of connect as humans, because you're sitting by yourself far away talking to your screen. That's what you're doing. But you need to give yourself the illusion that like it's Ashley on the other side and we're like having this conversation. So we've gotten really good at convincing ourselves that they're actually in the same room, even though they're not.
The Gossip, Rumors, and Lies thing is not something I heard before, and I love it. Gonna steal it. It's gonna become part of things that we do. That's amazing. But your point about the first start of the meeting, looking for things behind and all that, that is something I cannot, oh my goodness, like you need to. And like, particularly if you're like hybrid, if you've got a room full of people and then you got a couple people on Zoom or video or something like that, I think it's incredibly important to pull the video people into the conversation explicitly at the beginning of the conversation. In fact, this was a bone of contention I remember a while back with somebody who was not a very adept remote leader. And they said, I don't want small talk before all the meetings. And they had 15 people on a Zoom call. And I was like, we literally know nothing about these people. They're just boxes on a wall to us. If we don't start trying to pull them in, and that's such a dehumanizing thing that you then start treating them as commodities or resources, if you know what I mean by the air quote resources at this point. And I think it's just one of those things that you can lose.
Yeah. And you, just to riff on that a little bit, the inverse of that is true, is suddenly if you make it okay to be my video's off, I'm just kind of half listening to this conversation person in this meeting. And by the way, it's easy to do that because we don't have conference rooms that have a certain amount of people that can get anymore. So you can make them as large as you want. So there's an argument out there that like, cool, I just want to hear what y'all are saying. And I'm going to just turn my video off and listen. I'm like, nope, not going to happen. I have a huge problem with that because suddenly it's 48 people and there's four of us talking. This happens, by the way. And like there's 20 there and like 10 of them are literally not even in the room anymore because they just kind of turned it on and put it in the background. And now they're like cleaning their bookshelves or something. And they tell themselves, that they're listening. They're not listening. It's the same. This is why we have a huge problem when we're all together. And Ashley has his notebook open. he said, you're taking notes. I'm like, you're not, I'll take notes, or we'll have someone else take. You're a part of this meeting. If your notebook's open, I get 50% of your attention. What are you doing here? I'm being super adversarial about this, but like, I have an issue with this because I value people's time, and I want the meeting to be efficient. I want the people that are there to be contributing, and like this sort of like group of people that are just kind of hanging on. They could be working. They could be doing any other things. Giving them the impression they have to be there. We as leaders are failing in terms of saying, cool, we're going to document every decision and we're going to share it in Slack. So you don't feel you need to be here because we're going to share everything there. Like, there's this contract that's being failed. And then someone feels like this, I just want to be in that meeting. If I feel important. I get it. Like, I super get it. I want to be in that meeting too. But if I'm there, my video's on, I'm listening, I'm nodding, I'm a part of the conversation, even if I'm not necessarily saying something there. Ooh, I got a vent going on. Coffee's kicking in.
Oh, right now. Yeah, I think you, I mean, this is where we are going to violently and vehemently agree again, because it's one of those things where so when I started at GitHub, people used to tease me all the time because why is the CTO walking around GitHub with no laptop? And I literally only carried like a small Moleskine notebook with a pencil. I would have it in my pocket. I would take it out in the meeting to write one quick note and put it back in if I needed to go do something. But I literally would have no laptop with me when I went into a meeting, whereas most people would bring their laptops into the meeting, open them up, check Slack, do whatever. And it drove me crazy. And I said, hey, we're going to start closing these things. But they're like, dude, you're the CTO. You should always be on your laptop. I'm like, no, I should be in the room right now with you all. And we're making this type of decision. And yes, like maybe my mode of operation is slightly different than yours, but like we have to be here in the moment.
Yeah.
Instead of something taking an hour because we're all half paying attention, maybe we can get done 10 minutes too.
Yep. Totally agree. Yep. We totally 100% agree.
and I think there's a side note we can all agree on, that the hybrid meeting, the conference room plus the Zoom, is the biggest disaster ever invented.
Yeah, that's my worry about when we're all kind of coming back, is that scenario, because the folks on the virtual side of it are such a disadvantage to the folks in the room. So, and those folks are there for a reason, a really good reason. So it's actually going to get harder, because right now we're all required to be in these little boxes. But when there's five of us sitting in the conference room and five of us around the world, the five around the world, that is a whole new set of challenges we got to get good at. Hopefully, I'm hopeful in that we've been doing this for the last 20 months, that we know what it feels like to not be seen more than we did 20 months ago for us who hadn't done this a lot. But we'll see.
We'll see, is right. I think this goes to intentionality again and explicitness, but I think leaders, particularly senior ones, in any of those meetings, need to make it obviously known. You got to call people out. And to your point about having video off, no, you got to have a certain set of rules, and should be the small set of people, and they should be contributing, all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
Blah, blah, blah. It's like all the stuff we've always said before. And if you're in a meeting and you see it play out and you're on the wrong side, if you're on the video side of this, you see it playing out, oh my goodness, it's so frustrating.
So I want to ask you, Michael, on any kind of parting thoughts today. Explicitly, you know, the young engineering leader or someone who just became an engineering leader who's listening to this, what do you wish you would have known back in the day that you know today?
There's this, someone who's made this judgment thing about a set of skills. And long ago, and I don't know who it was, but they said soft skills. They said, these are the soft skills. And that soft skills somehow people read as being sort of the easier ones relative to hard skills. Like, I know how to program in C. That's a hard skill. Soft skill is, I know how to read the room and understand who's upset based on nothing except looking at little postage stamps. That's a soft skill, right? What I wish I'd told myself, whatever, a million years ago, was the soft skills are actually the hardest part of the job. And that's actually my whole shtick. The whole books that I've written are, you'll notice, don't do a lot of writing about unit tests or code coverage or anything like that, even though that's something I care about deeply. It's all what I consider to be the hard skills, which others think is called the soft piece. That piece has been my biggest successes and biggest failures, is how I've done that and gotten better at it. This reorg thing we were talking earlier. My reorgs are great, because it's zero drama and it's totally boring. Zero drama and totally boring is incredibly hard to do. And it comes from doing it so poorly and not understanding how people are feeling or how they want to be communicated to. The thing about leadership is, as a parting thought, is like, you're never rewarded when it's zero drama, nothing. But that's because we have this hero culture, and diving saves are the thing we do. no drama and everyone's fine is like great. Maybe I don't get rewarded from that because everyone's like, hey, the ops team's just kind of cranking. Is this kind of working? That's the hard part. And that comes from not from great being a great engineer. That comes from being a great leader who has understands and manages the hard skills / soft skills so well. Ooh, that was a good answer too, by the way.
It was a great answer. And you made my face go, ooh, 3 or 4 times on the video, which I like. By the way, I have started to frame it when people ask me about that too. And particularly when I'm talking to senior leaders, because they say, oh, you have really good soft skills. I'm like, yeah, I call them executive skills.
Yeah.
Because that's what they actually are, if you want to think about them that way. And that's what it takes to be a good executive. It helps some engineers, but more than that, I'm kind of pointing out to some of these other folks that they lack some of these things.
Yeah.
And the other side of the whole lack of drama thing, that's a whole nother podcast that we can go into. Because I find that most of the people that do end up in leadership positions in a lot of very large organizations would be considered the fire starters, the firemen fire starters, the ones that go out and they're like kind of starting fires on their own. They may not be explicitly doing it, but they're allowing embers to burn that become raging fires.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's a whole other podcast, but like they're trying to do something they think is right, by the way, in that. But it's usually some sort of systemic error or structure that is actually gives them the sense that they need to do that. There's something wrong there that actually needs to be debugged. Anyway, that's a whole other podcast.
Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today. It sounds like we're going to have you on again about an episode about drama. This was an absolute pleasure.
Mike, good to see you again. This was amazingly fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Developing Leadership. Make sure you subscribe to follow us on our journey towards more meaningful engineering leadership. If you have any challenges or topics you would like us to explore in an upcoming episode, go to developingleadership.co to submit them. To learn more about data-enabled engineering and how metrics can help your teams and improve your processes, go to athenian.co. See you in 2 weeks for another episode of Developing Leadership.